What do you do when the ocean in front of you has no runways? Juan Trippe had an answer for that. You build them. And when there's no land to build on, you find the islands. You send ships ahead with construction crews. You pour concrete on coral atolls that most people couldn't find on a map. You raise radio towers and fuel depots and a functioning hotel on Wake Island, which is nothing but a broken triangle of coral barely 4 feet above sea level in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And then you go. I'm Tail Dragger, here on the hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're going back to November of 1935 when a flying boat named the China Clipper lifted off from San Francisco Bay and turned her nose toward Manila and changed what the world thought was possible. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's go back to the beginning. Juan Terry Trippe was not a pilot in the romantic adventure-seeking mold. He was a businessman, a visionary. He founded Pan American World Airways in 1927, and from the very start he was playing a longer game than anyone else in the room. While other carriers were still figuring out their domestic networks, Trippe was looking at the ocean. The Atlantic had already been crossed, of course. Charles Lindbergh had done that in May of 1927 in the Spirit of St. Louis. Orion monoplane with a single engine and a fuel tank where the windshield should have been, but crossing an ocean solo for glory was one thing. Crossing it reliably, on schedule, with passengers and mail, that was something else entirely, and the Atlantic was the easy ocean. The Pacific is a different animal. From the California coast to Manila in the Philippines, following the island chain is roughly 8,000 miles. There is nothing out there. No emergency landing fields. No navigation beacons you can follow from one to the next, just water, and the weather systems that grind across it, and the night, stretching from one horizon to the other with nothing in between. Tripp understood that before you could fly the Pacific commercially, you had to build the Pacific. You had to create infrastructure where none existed, on islands that had been uninhabited for good reason. Beginning in 1935, Pan American sent supply ships out to Midway Island, Wake Island, and Guam. Construction crews went ashore on these remote fragments of coral and sand and built what was needed. Not just fuel storage, though, that was the heart of it. They built weather stations, radio stations capable of communicating across thousands of miles, crew quarters for overnight layovers, a small hotel on Wake so the passengers who would eventually follow could eat and sleep between legs. The cost was enormous. The logistics would have broken a lesser organization. Tripp kept pushing because he could see what was on the other side. Before you put a commercial aircraft on that route, however you survey it, carefully, Pan American had a flying boat called the Sikorsky S-42, a high-wing monoplane designed for overwater operations with four Pratt and Whitney Horn engines and enough range to reach islands that no airline had touched before. In the spring and summer of 1935, the Yeo S-42 made a series of survey flights progressively westward across the Pacific, each one a reconnaissance, each one extending the map a little further, testing the island facilities, working out the radio procedures, learning what the ocean required of you before you committed to it on a schedule. The survey pilot for those flights was a man named Edwin Music. I want you to know this name. Edwin Music was Pan American's chief pilot, and by 1935 he was widely considered the finest long-range flying boat pilot in the world, a quiet man methodical to a degree that sometimes unnerved the people around him. He believed that preparation was the only real form of courage, and he prepared for every flight, as though the ocean were actively trying to kill him. Which, to be fair, it sometimes was. Music had logged more overwater hours in flying boats than almost any other aviator alive. He was not given to grand gestures or dramatic statements. He sought precision the way some men seek fame, and he found it, and that is why Tripp kept giving him the hardest routes. The procedures Music developed during those survey flights became the operating standard for Trans-Pacific Commercial Aviation. He was in effect writing the book as he flew one leg at a time over water that had never seen a commercial aircraft. By autumn of 1935, the pieces were in place. The island bases were ready, the crews were trained, and Pan American had taken delivery of the airplane that would make the crossing for real. The Martin M130, built by the Glenn L. Martin Company in Baltimore, Maryland. Three were delivered to Pan American, and they were unlike anything flying at the time. The M130 had a wingspan of 130 feet, four Pratt and Whitney Twin Wasp radial engines, generating over 3,000 horsepower combined. A deep, broad hull shaped to operate from open water, designed to lift off in the rolling chop of a harbor and set back down gently in a Pacific swell. The aircraft weighed over 52,000 pounds fully loaded, and inside that hull, something no other airliner of that era could offer. The cabin had sleeping berths for overnight legs, a proper dining saloon with white linen tablecloths and china dishes, a cocktail lounge, separate compartments that gave passengers something approaching privacy, which was an almost unheard of luxury in an aircraft. The whole airplane was designed around the idea that crossing the Pacific was not simply a transit. It was a journey, and the journey itself was part of what you were paying for. The ticket price for the eventual passenger service reflected exactly that. Crossing the Pacific on a clipper cost more than most Americans earned in a year. This was not transportation for the general public. It was something closer to an ocean voyage by air, and the people who flew it dressed accordingly. The three Martin flying boats were given names that reached back into maritime tradition: the China Clipper, the Philippine Clipper, the Hawaii Clipper. Trippe chose the word clipper deliberately. It invoked the great sailing ships that had once pushed the limits of what the sea would allow, carrying cargo and passengers to the same distant ports. The imagery was conscious and it worked. The name Clipper became synonymous with the romance of long-distance flight in a way that no other airline brand of that era quite matched. November 22, 1935, Alameda, California. The eastern shore of San Francisco Bay. A gray November afternoon, the water flat and cold, a low marine layer sitting on the hills across the bay. An estimated 150,000 people had gathered along the waterfront. Let that number settle for a moment. 150,000 people on a workday. Some of them had been there since before dawn to get a good vantage point. They had come because they sensed, even if they couldn't have fully articulated it, that what they were about to watch was a pivot point in the history of how human beings moved through the world. James Farley, the Postmaster General of the United States, was on the dock. He was there to personally hand over the first bags of Trans-Pacific airmail, making it official, making it governmental, making it real in the way that an official act can make something real. Newsreel cameras were running. Radio correspondents were broadcasting live. The departure of a flying boat with a load of mail had become a national event. Captain Edwin Music sat in the left seat of the China Clipper and went through his pre-flight the same way he always did. Methodical, unhurried, every item checked and confirmed before moving to the next. The crew numbered 7, the cargo was airmail. Over 100,000 individual pieces of correspondence, sorted and bagged and loaded into the hull, waiting to travel farther by air than airmail had ever traveled before. The engine started one at a time, 4 big radials coughing to life, the propellers turning, the sound building from a ragged idle into a deep, steady roar that carried across the water and into the crowd on the dock. The smell of exhaust and salt air mixed together in the November cold. The mooring lines were cast off. The China Clipper taxied out toward the center of the bay, turned into what wind there was, and the throttles went forward. She began to accelerate across the water, her hull throwing spray to either side, the noise rising, and then her bow lifted and her tail came up and she was on the step, and then she was airborne, pulling away from the surface of the bay, climbing steadily, her 4 engines at full power, her shadow shrinking on the water below her. The crowd watched her climb out toward the southwest. Some of them had tears running down their faces. Music leveled off and turned toward Hawaii. The afternoon lay ahead of him, and then the night, and then 2,400 miles of open Pacific before the first landfall. Now here's where it gets interesting, because what happened over the next 7 days was not dramatic in the way that aviation adventures usually get told. There was no crisis, no emergency, no heroic improvisation over the black water. There was instead something rarer in the history of flight. Professionalism executed at the edge of what was possible. Each leg of the route required hours of flying over open water with no land visible in any direction. The navigation was celestial. Music's navigator shot sun lines and star fixes through the astrodome in the top of the fuselage, worked the math by hand on a plotting board, and passed corrected headings forward to the cockpit. Radio bearings from the Pan American stations along the route provided cross-checks, but for long stretches those bearing lines were thin and imprecise over that kind of distance. You were, in the truest sense, out there, relying on the training, the preparation, the calculations, and the aircraft. Music flew each leg the way he flew everything. Precisely, any deviation from the planned heading or altitude was noted and corrected immediately. Fuel consumption was monitored against the plan, weather observations were logged and transmitted back along the radio chain. Every hour of flying generated data that would be used on the next survey, the next flight, the next captain who followed in his wake. They overnighted at each island base, Midway, Wake, Guam. The crews rested in the quarters Pan American had built. The aircraft was refueled and inspected at each stop, every system checked before the next leg began. What had seemed like a wildly expensive and logistically absurd investment, building those island facilities, proved its value completely at each stop. Music had everything he needed, exactly where he needed it, in the middle of an ocean that had never offered a pilot anything before. The China Clipper arrived in Manila on November 29, 1935, 7 days out of Alameda, 59 hours, and 48 minutes of total flying time spread across 5 overwater legs. In Manila, the reception was enormous. Officials, press, newsreel crews, dignitaries from the Philippine government and from Pan American's local offices. The arrival had been anticipated for a week. The Pacific crossing had been followed in newspapers on both sides of the ocean. Music stepped off the aircraft, shook the required hands, gave the brief statement that was expected of him, and went to look at his airplane. That was Music Pan American, began passenger service on the Trans-Pacific route in October of 1936, and the Clippers, as they were universally known by then, became the most prestigious way to travel on Earth. Writers flew them. Diplomats, industrialists, people who made that crossing in the late 1930s, speak of it with a reverence that you simply don't hear applied to air travel today. They were sleeping in berths somewhere over the Central Pacific. They were eating hot meals off real plates in a saloon 30 feet above an ocean that nobody had crossed commercially in any direction 5 years before. The world had gotten smaller, and the getting smaller was itself part of the experience. Now here's the part that is a little hard to sit with. All three of the Martin Clippers were eventually lost. The China Clipper herself went down in December of 1945, near Port of Spain in Trinidad, during a night approach and reduced visibility. The Philippine Clipper crashed near Wake Island in January of 1943. After the war had changed everything about what the Pacific meant, the Hawaii Clipper disappeared over the Philippine Sea in July of 1938. With 15 people aboard, no wreckage was ever recovered. The ocean kept that one. And Edwin Music didn't make it that long. On January 11, 1938, Music was at the controls of the Sikorsky S-42 on a survey flight out of Pago Pago in American Samoa. Pan American was scouting a route to New Zealand. An oil leak developed in one of the engines. Music made the decision to return and began dumping fuel to reduce the aircraft's weight for landing. The aircraft exploded. The subsequent investigation concluded that fuel from the dump valves had almost certainly contacted a hot exhaust component, an equipment failure that met a procedural gap at exactly the wrong moment. The kind of thing that comes for careful men eventually, if enough variables align against you. Edwin Music was 43 years old. He had spent his career proving that the Pacific could be crossed safely, repeatedly, on a schedule, by professional crews following sound procedures. He had written those procedures himself, he had trained the men who would fly those routes after him, and he died the way he had lived, trying to bring an airplane and its crew home from a route he was still working to understand. The routes kept flying, the infrastructure kept functioning. When the war came and the Clippers were pressed into military service, they operated on the framework Music and his crews had built. When commercial aviation rebuilt itself after the war, it rebuilt on that same foundation, with larger aircraft and longer range and eventually jet engines, that made the island stops unnecessary. But the logic of the Trans-Pacific route, the basic shape of how you get from California to Asia by air, was drawn first by a flying boat named the China Clipper and the quiet, methodical man in her left seat. The next time you find yourself settled into a seat somewhere over the Pacific, drink in hand, the darkness outside going all the way to the horizon with nothing below it but dark water, think about what it took to make that ordinary. Think about 150,000 people standing on a waterfront in November of 1935, watching a flying boat climb away from the bay and disappear into the west. They were watching the world change, and they knew it. And so they stayed until she was out of sight. Sources today include Robert Daly's An American Saga, The Definitive History of Pan American Airways, and records held by the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. You can find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger, that's the hangar. Fly safe.